People often say great minds think alike. Great minds don't think alike. They challenge each other to think again. A lot of people think that harmony is about always being on the same page. But if you actually think about what musical harmony is, it's the pleasing arrangement of different tones.
That's organizational psychologist Adam Grant, an advisor to America's top corporations, government agencies, celebrities, even royalty like Prince Harry.
What does the term mental fitness mean to you?
It means being at peak cognitive and emotional functioning.
I'm Margaret Hoover. This is the Firing Line Podcast. Grant is the youngest ever tenured professor at Wharton. His most recent bestseller, Think Again, makes the case for reconsidering one's most strongly held beliefs.
Learning is when you change your mind because you encounter better logic or stronger evidence. And if you don't change your mind in the face of new facts, then you are basically closing the door to evolving.
Grant admits, returning to the era of civil discourse may require the likes of Doc Brown. How do we get back to that?
Time machine? We need a DeLorean or a Tesseract right now.
Great Scott!
But he told me there is still hope that people who disagree can agree to respect one another, even on issues as charged as abortion. But it requires a mental shift.
If you're liberal, imagine you were born in a religious family. If you're conservative, imagine you were born on one of the coasts to a bunch of atheists. They go from complaining about baby killers and woman oppressors to saying, I don't agree with your stance on the policy, but I respect the fact that you have a worthy principle behind it.
So how did I stump him?
This is really hard. I don't know if you can make a persuasive argument.
Adam Grant, welcome to Firing Line.
Delighted to be here.
You wrote the most read article on the New York Times website in 2021 in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic. And the title, there's a name for that blah you're feeling. It's called languishing. You argued that Americans were collectively feeling a sense of languishing. And that sensation of stagnation and emptiness could be helped by just naming it. Now that we're in July of 2022, the pandemic is ongoing. Inflation is high. Gas prices are high. Political polarization continues. Are Americans still languishing, or would you call it something else?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I think a lot of people are still languishing, in part because of the circumstances you're describing, but also in part because languishing is a feature of the human condition. People have languished for millennia, right? We used to call it ennui, was another term for it. But that sense of aimlessness and joylessness can happen to anyone. It can happen in any situation where you feel like the world around you is stagnating and you're not able to make any progress. And I think a lot of people are feeling that right now. I don't think it's quite as severe now from the data that I've seen. I think as the worst of the pandemic hopefully appears to be behind us, a lot of people have started to realize, okay, I got through that, I can get through almost anything. And so we're starting to see a little bit of the tip from my perspective of what's called post-traumatic growth, which is the idea of not just bouncing back, but bouncing forward, where people say, I wish that hadn't happened, but because I'm stuck with it, I'm going to walk away stronger, I'm going to be more grateful, I'm going to have deeper relationships with people, and I'm going to have a new sense of possibility and purpose. And so I think there's some of that post-traumatic growth combating the languishing, but I think for a lot of people, it still feels like they're muddling through the day-to-day. And whether you go to the sociologists and psychologists who study it, or the great philosopher Mariah Carey, who wrote a song about it, right? Languishing is something that can wax and wane for any of us. And I think it does help to focus on the emotion as opposed to just the circumstances. So if we go back to the early days of the pandemic, I think one of the mistakes a lot of people made is they said, well, I don't know what to do. I've never lived through a pandemic before. And Margaret, it is true, unless you're 103 years old, you probably have not lived through one, and you then wouldn't remember it very well.
Right.
But when you shifted your attention from the outer circumstances to the inner emotion, you could say, I've languished before. Like that night where I binged an entire season of a TV show and then realized at the end, I think I've already seen that, right? That was languishing. And when you recognize you felt that emotion before, you can then learn lessons from your own past resilience and begin to move forward from it.
Well, you've talked about the importance of flow, right? For this, based on this research by Mihai Csikszentmihalyi. And that when you're in flow, you are entirely consumed and your senses and your focus is entirely consumed and absorbed in a single activity. and that can help one break free of languishing. That you did this during the pandemic by playing the video game Mario Kart with your family that was dispersed across the country. How are you finding your flow now?
Well, Mario Kart is alive and well. we actually just
did you do it as much as you did during the pandemic?
Not quite. Yeah. But actually what we find is we play it a lot in the summer. We often have a daily game in the summer, and then it becomes kind of a weekly game throughout the school year. I think that some people took that too literally, right? So I talked about...
You weren't advocating video games.
I'm not like Mario Kart is the cure for languishing, right? The question is, what's your version of Mario Kart? And what I love about Mario Kart is it gives me a sense of mastery. There is nothing like the joy that I get out of, you know, placing a banana peel so that my brother-in-law will slip on it. It forces me to be mindful. Like, if you look at your phone for a split second, your car veers off the road and crashes. And the weird thing was, it also felt like I mattered, because during the pandemic, my kids, you know, were sort of looking for something to do. It was hard to have something to look forward to. They were in online school, and I remember they were learning how to independently mute and unmute themselves, and that was on their kindergarten report card. And I felt like I was able to create something that energized them and excited them. And so I guess I'd always thought about flow as an individual activity. But in Mario Kart, we had this peak flow because our whole family was engaged in this, you know, this experience. And so I think that a lot of us basically see getting into individual flow as a reward for finishing our to-do list. What I want to know is, does that belong on your to-do list? And can you share it with other people?
You describe moments that you refer to as collective effervescence that were lost during the lockdown. Perhaps you achieved that with your family and playing Mario Kart, but you also talk about how most of us lost a sense of collective effervescence during the pandemic. Now, as we look back, you know, we don't know how COVID and long COVID in particular is going to affect the human body, but what about how COVID in particular will affect the human psyche? Will we bounce back? Or will this sort of linger in the way long COVID does to the body?
Well, I think it's a really important question. And the data on this are surprising to a lot of people. So not only will we bounce back, many people have already bounced back. If you look at the mental health trends during the pandemic, by the summer of 2020, there was actually a substantial rebound. And I think that what psychologists like to talk about is the psychological immune system. That just like our body has a physical immune system to protect us from germs, there's a psychological immune system that helps us manage some of the difficult events in our lives. And you know, we saw a lot of people, there was a sourdough craze, right? That was the psychological immune system kicking in and saying, I'm going to find something that allows me to contribute to my family, to learn a new skill, to feel connected to other people and stave off some of the loneliness. I think we've also seen another kind of rebound, which is maybe the untold story of the last year, is people got more generous. Rates of volunteering, helping strangers, and giving to charity all went up. And that is the default in all kinds of disaster and tragedy, right? The news likes to amplify the horror and the pain. But the reality is that what most people do is they reach out in times of need. And I think that's a hopeful story about the human condition, right? That when people are depending on you, you often find strength you didn't know you had. And that's something we need to write about. That's something we need to mark, because otherwise we don't notice that it's happening.
As an organizational psychologist, you've consulted for some of the world's top companies, Google, some of the world's top institutions, NASA. And I've heard you say that hybrid work is the global experiment of 2022. What's your hypothesis for how this experiment is playing out?
Well, I think hybrid is the future, and maybe even the present too. We saw many companies commit to return to office plans and then abandon them because people didn't want to do it, but also because the evidence is strong that as long as people are in the office together about half the week, on average, if you let them work from anywhere the rest of the week, they're more productive, more satisfied, more likely to stay, no cost to their promotion opportunities, their collaboration, or their relationships. And I think a lot of leaders have been dragged kicking and screaming into this, saying, but how do I micromanage you if I'm not sitting next to you? And forgetting that if they want to earn trust, the best way to do that is to show trust, right? If you give people a little bit of freedom and flexibility, they reciprocate that with loyalty and commitment. there are challenges with hybrid work. It's harder, for example, to do informal learning and mentoring when we don't walk out of a meeting and debrief it, right? The meeting just ends and we disappear if we're in a Zoom call. It's a little bit harder to feel a sense of culture when you're not in the same room with people. But that doesn't mean we need to be sitting next to each other every day of the week, right? The 5-day work week is a human invention. The idea of being physically co-located is a human invention. And so we can reinvent those practices.
So are you saying productivity has remained the same despite the changing dynamics of place?
Well, there's a confound in the global experiment, which is COVID, right? So separate the effects of remote and hybrid work from a pandemic. That's a hard thing to do. What we do have, though, are experiments that were done pre-pandemic showing that in call centers, for example, this was a great Nick Bloom experiment in China, where when people in a call center are randomly assigned to work from home, they're 13% more productive and they're half as likely to quit. And so that allowed us to show that remote work could work pre-COVID. Nick has now done experiments in the hybrid world where he shows that if we take people even during COVID and we, instead of having them on site 5 days, we agree on what 3 days we're going to show up. They're just as effective. They're more satisfied and retention is higher. And they're every bit as likely to get good performance reviews. So I think we're in good shape in terms of these practices reinventing the future of work. I think what we don't know yet is how is this going to play out for different jobs, different cultures, different industries. And Margaret, I normally hate to do this, which is I'm about to use a sports metaphor to talk about work. Are you ready for this?
And take it.
Okay, normally I worry it leaves out half the population. And also it's just a stretch.
That's so sexist.
Well, I'm not saying, I think maybe...
Oh, I just assumed it was
assuming.
Women. Maybe
I'm just saying half the population loves sports, right? So let's just say, maybe I shouldn't say half the population. When I use a sports metaphor, it leaves out people who don't like sports. But it's also it's a stretch for work. When was the last time that on your job, you agreed exactly on how to keep score, and then you hired a bunch of referees to enforce the rules, right? So I think it's ridiculous that when people talk about work as, like, we're going to win, and yet, this is a time when I'm going to do it. Because when we look at collaboration at work, there are three different types of interdependence, and they map beautifully onto individual sport, relay sport, and team sport. So in an individual sport job that's like gymnastics, you can basically let people be remote almost all the time. They can go off and do their own floor, maybe their own vault, beam, and bar routines, and then the whole will be the sum of the parts. If you're running a relay race, though, you've got to make sure there's some synchronous communication between the person who's passing the baton and the person who's receiving it. And where we really, I think, need to be in the same place or at least on the same time zone is when we're doing a true team sport like basketball. So if I'm going to pass you the ball and then it comes back to me and then it goes to someone else and it goes to you again, then we've got to have some real-time windows where we can bounce ideas off of each other and we can motivate each other. And I don't think we've had enough of that conversation. I'd love to see more people ask, wait, what sport are we playing right now? And then decide their levels of synchrony accordingly.
Last year in the United States, 47 million people quit their jobs. This is referred to as the Great Resignation. With the economy now approaching a slowdown, established companies and startups making cuts in the workforce, the so-called Great Resignation may be over. But have the fundamental issues that caused so many employees to quit been resolved?
No, and I'm not sure it's over actually because of some of these factors. So if you look at
what are the factors?
Yeah, so if you look at why people have quit at above expected rates, a lot of them would have quit anyway, right? But my read of the US data is people were quitting at least 20% more often than expected pre-pandemic. I know of four factors that seem to be driving those decisions to walk away. One is being underpaid and finally throwing your hands up and saying, I can't take it anymore. Two is probably a taste of freedom, that people got a sense of flexibility when they didn't have a boss breathing down their neck anymore, and they wanted more of it. So they started looking for, a lot of people said, I'm going to strike out on my own as an entrepreneur, or I'm going to join the creator economy or the gig economy. A lot of people said, I'm going to look for an organization that takes flexibility really seriously and gives people choices, not just about where they work, but about what they work on and who they work with, and especially when and how much they have to work. So then a third factor seems to be burnout, that a lot of people were just exhausted. And Yeah, that persistent and impairing sense of stress that, you know, that we describe as burnout, that existed pre-pandemic, but it intensified during the pandemic. And then four, what's causing that burnout? More than anything else, it seems to be toxic culture. There was a great study published earlier this year looking at the drivers of turnover. Toxic culture was 10 times more important than anything else in predicting whether people were going to leave or stay in their jobs. And if you look at toxic culture, you can measure it with five different markers. One is feeling disrespected. A second is being excluded, especially if you're a member of an underrepresented group. A third is being actively abused or harassed. A fourth is dealing with unethical behavior. And then a fifth is seeing selfish or cutthroat, or what I've called having people around you who are takers rather than givers. And I don't think those factors are changing, right? As we move into an economic slowdown, we still see people underpaid. We still see people wanting more flexibility. We still see people burning out, and toxic cultures are sadly alive and well. And I think people are going to keep jumping ship until we really rethink what it means to be a workplace and try to build a real community where people can do meaningful work and feel trusted and respected by the people around them.
You know, it reminds me of the work-life balance research you've conducted. Has the pandemic changed Americans' priorities in terms of how much of themselves they're willing to dedicate to a job?
I would love to see better data on this. It's such a good question. I think anecdotally, from what I've seen, more people have walked home from work one day, which I mean, you know, like walked from their home office to their kitchen, which might be the same place, and said, "I don't want my life to be defined by work. Why do I arrange my whole life around work? What if I could figure out what my life priorities are and then fit my job into that?" And I think there's been a really interesting anti-ambition movement, right? I've seen a growing number of our students at Wharton. I've also just heard from a growing number of my work-life podcast listeners saying, "Why do we have to worship at the altar of hustle? Why do we pray to a high priest of grit? Shouldn't we think about what matters to us in life and then try to figure out, okay, well, how can my work support that?" And I've also seen a lot of leaders and managers sort of wake up and realize, you know what, if people don't have quality of life, I'm not going to get quality work. And if there is a silver lining of COVID for our jobs, it's that for the first time in my two decades as an organizational psychologist, we have many leaders and managers realizing that mental health is part of health. I loved an example of a manager who said to a team, "Look, it's okay to call in sick. It's also okay to call in sad." And Margaret, what I loved about that was not the idea that now we're going to give you five sad days a year, and if you don't use them by December, we're going to take them away, right? It was the idea of normalizing the fact that just as if you got the flu or long COVID, we would expect you to take care of yourself and take some time off, that if you are depressed, anxious, burned out, even just languishing, that it's okay to take some time to try to recharge. And I think it's obviously helpful for leaders and managers to deliver that message, but I want to see them go further. And the leaders who have impressed me most during COVID are the ones who proactively announced to their teams, "I am taking a mental health day," or "I am going to take a recharge week," which legitimates that behavior for everyone else.
Gwyneth Paltrow, J.J. Abrams, former Firing Line guests Melinda Gates and Sheryl Sandberg have all come to you for advice. These are just some of the influential individuals that come to Adam Grant for your wisdom, for your research, for your insight. Even last week, Prince Harry posted an exchange that you had on his wellness campaign called Better Up, where you serve on an advisory board. He asked about the return companies get when they invest in resilient workforces. And you told him, quote, "I cannot overstate the importance of a leader and a manager saying, 'I care more about your well-being than I do about your results.'" So you're saying caring about employees is good for the bottom line.
In the long run. Yeah, it's. I think a lot of leaders see it as a cost, right? Or as a distraction. In the short term, maybe it is. In the long run, people generally will not care about your mission unless you care about them. Full stop.
Is that generational? Because with all the data we've read about millennials and then Gen Z coming up behind them, I mean, these are not characteristics that define Gen X or the baby boomer generation. So how much of this is generational and how much of this is the new normal based on the circumstances created by a new economy and COVID?
I'm pretty skeptical of claims that generations differ in their fundamental values. I think that human values are part of our psyche, and they don't seem to just radically shift from one generation to the next. I think a lot of the claims that we make about generational differences are stereotypes, right? They're generalizations about an entire group of people that happen to be born in the same roughly 20-year window and assuming they have a bunch of common characteristics.
So then what changes? Cultural values change?
Well, I think what changes is people's expectations and the way that they express their values. One of the ways that we try to tease apart generation and age in psychology, which is often a problem for people when they're talking about this, like when we make a claim about millennials, is it because of the life stage they're at, or is it because of the period in history when they were born? When psychologists try to get to the bottom of that, what they do is they actually take surveys that were done of people at the same age in different generations. So you get surveys of high school seniors or college seniors from the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, et cetera. And what you see is the work values, for example, are fundamentally the same. We're all looking for interesting, meaningful work. We want a job that can support our lifestyle and our families. We want to have a successful career. We want to be able to do work that makes a difference in the lives of others. And we want a job that allows for some leisure time and also allows us to make friends. And we not only roughly care about those things to the same degree in each generation, we rank them in the same order. And so I think that we should be really careful when we assume that this premium on caring about people is a millennial goal. I think what's changed is that millennials are more self-expressive than other generations, right? So they're a lot more likely to tell you, and they also have the communication tools to make it very, very apparent when they are not getting what they want. And that's true of Gen Z as well. And so I don't think it's a generational shift so much as I think it's a set of expectations that have changed and a set of tools and technologies that have made it possible to voice those expectations and actually get heard.
Your bestseller from 2021, Think Again, The Power of Knowing What You Don't Know, helps make the case to readers that the ability to rethink one's own opinions and assumptions is a critical characteristic for success. But you also recognize that there is humility that is required in this exercise. Why is the conventional wisdom, don't second guess yourself, wrong?
Well, it's wrong for a lot of reasons. Although I guess I reserve the right to rethink that, which in a larger sense would prove the point I'm trying to make, right? But I think one of the reasons it's wrong is because when people trust their gut, they're relying on intuition.
I've heard you say intuition is just...
It's subconscious pattern recognition.
So all intuition is subconscious pattern recognition.
Yeah.
So when people are trusting their gut, what are they doing?
What they're doing is they're relying on the lessons they learned from the past, and intuition is able to detect those patterns much more quickly than conscious thought is. And so then the question is, well, when are those patterns reliable? And the answer is, if you are making a decision in the same kind of situation where you built up your intuition. So if you're in a stable environment, if you're a firefighter, for example, there's a lot of evidence showing that a firefighter, if you have them make a snap intuitive judgment of, am I in a dangerous moment right now? Is this building going to collapse? Their intuition will be more accurate than their conscious assessment because their intuition rapidly recognizes a bunch of patterns that they may not even be fully aware of. If you are a stockbroker, though, your intuition is essentially garbage, because the conditions of the market in which you built up your intuition are no longer present. And so those patterns are going to trap you in the principles of the past as opposed to helping you forecast the future. So instead of trusting your gut, what I want to encourage people to do is to test your gut, right? To ask yourself, okay, is my experience from the past relevant to the present and the future? And the less sure you are that you're in a similar situation, the more you need to rethink the assumptions that you've made, because very often your instincts and your best practices were built up for a world that does not exist anymore.
When we think about reexamining your suppositions or reexamining your conclusions, one of the places where this is most difficult and least acceptable is in our politics. I want to give you an example. Representative Adam Kinzinger from Illinois, a Republican from Illinois, came to Congress in 2011. He's in the military. He came in completely opposed to any kind of gun reform or gun reform legislation. He still calls himself a defender of the Second Amendment, but just last month, he signed on to the first bipartisan federal gun legislation in almost 30 years. He reevaluated his thinking after mass shootings in El Paso and Dayton. And you and I both know that it is almost impossible for elected officials to change their mind without being called flip-floppers or without really being attacked for being seen as weak.
Yeah.
How can we make it more politically tenable for political leaders to reexamine their thinking in the face of new evidence and circumstances?
That is such an important question. It might be the defining question of our times. And I think the starting point for me is to recognize that changing your mind doesn't necessarily make you a hypocrite. It might mean that you've learned something. And the question is, why are you changing your mind? It's not whether you've changed your mind, right? It's why. If you're changing your mind because you're trying to cater to your constituents, then I think it's reasonable to ask, is this person flip-flopping? Do they have real integrity?
Flip-flopping is an opportunistic change of mind.
Yeah, exactly, where you're basically abandoning your principles, and now I have questions about your moral character. But learning is when you change your mind because you encounter better logic or stronger evidence. And if you don't change your mind in the face of new facts, then you are basically closing the door to evolving. And last time I checked, learning is not about affirming what you already believe. It's about evolving what you believe. Let's take a little thought experiment. Imagine that Abraham Lincoln were president today. He would be called a hypocrite because he stated clearly before he entered the Oval Office that he was not going to abolish slavery. It's not that he supported slavery. He was afraid that what became the Emancipation Proclamation would tear the Union apart. And so he had a very clear principle that his number one priority was to preserve the American experiment. Well, guess what? We are all lucky that he changed his mind, right? He didn't abandon his principles. He changed his policies and his
practices. And also when he was elected, the Union was torn apart by secession.
Anyway, right?
Ergo, he wasn't going to make it any worse.
But yes. Yeah. This is exactly what I would ask politicians to do, is I would ask them, what are your current principles? And what are the conditions that would change your mind? And if they pre-commit to the evidence and the information that would lead them to shift, then all of a sudden, when they evolve according to that information, when the world changes, they change with it. Now I know they're learning and they're not being hypocrites. And I don't think we spend enough time asking politicians to explain, okay, look, I know you're a supporter of the Second Amendment. And I know right now what that means is you're trying to protect the right to bear arms in a variety of ways. What kinds of events in America would have to happen to lead you to wonder if we're taking that freedom too far? And if there aren't ways to give people that freedom and still protect them from mass shootings? Maybe we could even fulfill both of those values at the same time. Maybe.
I mean, as you know, there are many people in our politics who would pridefully say, there are no circumstances or conditions under which my mind would be changed. And they would be rewarded by their voters for taking that position.
Do you really think that?
In the base of the Republican Party, absolutely.
I'm not so sure.
Tell me why.
Well, I think that there's, first of all, there's a risk that some of these candidates end up looking completely stubborn and inflexible, right? And nobody wants to be led by a politician who refuses to ever learn. Now, the question is, are there some single issue voters or maybe sacred issues where people are okay with that? Sure. So maybe we don't start on guns. We start on tax policy, right? Which people have a little bit less of a vested interest in. It's incredibly boring, right? But it's part of normalizing this conversation.
Totally.
I would actually be excited to say, okay, let's take, for example, the progressive tax question, right? So I'm an independent. I don't belong to a political party. I like to think for myself, and it doesn't make sense to me that I should, you know, have a set of beliefs just because there's a group of people that happen to overlap with some of my beliefs, and I should follow everything that they think is important. As somebody who is really interested in trying to make sure that everybody has an opportunity to succeed in America, one of the questions I think about a lot is, should we have a higher progressive tax rate? And when I've spoken with a lot of conservative politicians, they've often said, no, that goes against my principles. And America is the land of opportunity. And then what I want to know is, well, what would change your mind? Like, what if we had data from the US that a progressive tax rate was successful? And it turns out, right, billionaires were roughly taxed, in the 90% range? back in the 1950s, as I understand it. And when I mention that, they kind of light up a little bit and they're intrigued, right? They say, well, tell me more about that. Like, maybe that was actually something that I could get behind and we could look at whether I could follow that policy without it giving up on my principles. And I don't know whether that's a good idea. I'm not an economist, right? I don't have the expertise to weigh in on what our tax policies should be, but I would sure be excited to hear a politician say, here is my current view of how we should be taxing people at different levels of income. And here is the evidence that I would love to see that would help me rethink that.
Okay. So then let's take this approach to my skepticism. Because as you know, many Republicans still believe that Donald Trump won the election and they believe in Donald Trump's election lie, that Joe Biden is an illegitimate president. If you were face to face with an election denier, how would you make a persuasive argument?
This is really hard. I don't know if you can make a persuasive argument.
Because there are some people who simply won't engage with the possibility that they're wrong.
Yeah. So the first thing I would do is I would get out of preacher and prosecutor mode. I'm right. You're wrong. Right? The harder I work to proselytize my views and attack yours, the more likely you are to disengage altogether. Or when I show up in prosecutor mode, you bring your defense attorney to court and then neither of us is willing to budge. What I would do is I would sit down with that person and say, it sounds like you are really convinced that Donald Trump won the election. What evidence would change your mind on that? And if you say nothing, which I've had happen, I say, okay, I just wanted to be clear. This is a religion for you. This is an article of faith that you take as seriously as your faith in God, no matter who you spoke to or what information you saw, you're not going to budge. And most of the time people backpedal when I say that. And they say, well, no, of course, if I were to see the following, I would reconsider. And that's then, you know, a little bit of a foot in the door, right? You're not necessarily going to change their mind in that conversation, but changing people's deep-seated beliefs, especially when they're consistent with their hopes and dreams, is not an overnight project, right? It's almost a lifetime commitment. And so what I want to do is I actually don't want to make an argument in that conversation. I just want to get them to reflect on if there's anything that would change their mind. And guess what? Now they're in the driver's seat. They feel a sense of ownership of their own beliefs. They're not under threat. They don't have to put up a shield. And then the second thing that I would probably do, there's a lot of research on what psychologists call a motivational interviewing, which is the idea that I can't change your mind, but I can help you change your own mind. If I ask you questions that lead you to see the ambivalence you might have or the nuances in your own views.
Most of the folks that you talk to will cite the things that they've seen in the media because they trust their trusted media sources.
And that's the kicker here, right? When people believe things that aren't true, when they're drawn to conspiracy theories, it's the problem is not one of information, it's one of trust. Right? They are, generally speaking, if you look at what draws people to conspiracy theories, they are looking to feel, generally speaking, people want to feel like they have unique knowledge. They want to feel that they're in control in a world that feels out of control. And so it's much more comforting to believe that there are a few powerful people that are orchestrating the system for their own gain than to believe, you know what? Like, sometimes the world is unfair and I'm the victim of that.
You write about binary bias and the human tendency to seek clarity by simplifying every issue into two categories. So adding complexity and nuance is actually a way out of our hyperpolarization.
Yeah. Binary bias is all around us. And the more charged an issue is, the more likely we are to take a complex spectrum of issues and beliefs and oversimplify it by dumbing it down into only two categories. I love Robert Benchley's take on this when he wrote that there are only two kinds of people in the world, those who divide the world into two kinds of people and those who don't, right? And too many of us are in that first camp.
But take a hot button issue that's relevant in this moment, abortion.
Yeah.
How does complexity theory apply here?
Well, okay, so there are two ways to think about this. One is the issue itself, and the other is the people who are on the other extreme from you. So let's start with the issue. What most people do is they divide the world into pro-lifers and pro-choicers, right? And one is good and one is bad. What we forget, though, is there are tons of nuances there. Let me take an outrageous example. There is no pro-choice person who would say it is morally or medically acceptable to abort a healthy baby at 40 weeks just because the parents decided that was a good idea, right? So we are all pro-life in that situation. There is also, I think, no reasonable human being who would say it is wrong to get an abortion at week 10 if the mother's life is in danger and the baby is no longer viable and this was a case of rape or incest. There may be some people who reject that, but the majority of Republicans don't. Right? Most Republicans say that is a condition where I support abortion. And so why are we saying I'm pro-life or pro-choice? What we should be saying is, let's talk about the conditions where we draw the line. And we say the choice should exist or it shouldn't. Also, you could say, the question of, is there a constitutional right or should this go to the states? It's being caricatured as basically, does the government have the right to control your body or not? Right? And that's not actually the question here. The question is, which government has the right? If we have that nuanced discussion, it's worth thinking about. I was personally disappointed to see Roe v. Wade overturned. I was outraged, right? That as somebody who believes in both the sanctity of life and bodily autonomy, that federal protections don't exist. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized, well, if we live in a world where federal rights are difficult to maintain, I'm going to rely a lot on my state. And so let's talk about when should the state protect you? When should the federal government protect you? Okay, so that's complexifying the issue. Now let's talk about the people. Can we do that too?
Yeah.
All right, so Tim Kundrow and I ran a series of experiments where we started with the premise that what you're encouraged to do, everyone did this after Donald Trump was elected, listen to the other side, take their perspective. And guess what? On charged issues, when somebody's on the other side of a spectrum from you, the more you try to take their perspective, the less likely you are to see their perspective because you're just guessing and you do not want to see the good in them. You're likely to think of them, Margaret, if I can infer where you stand on abortion, you're likely to say, well, you just want to control women and oppress women, right? And what we did was we asked, okay, well, what's an alternative to that? Like, surely there aren't, millions and millions of people who are motivated to control women, especially conservative women. I'm guessing not all of them want to control women's bodies. So how do we get people to realize that? One of the ways we get to that is we said, can you reflect on your life having followed a different trajectory? Imagine you were born in a family that had the opposite views on abortion. If you're liberal, imagine you were born in a religious family. If you're conservative, imagine you were born on one of the coasts to a bunch of atheists. Or we also, another way we did this was we said, look, these views are not consistent. They're not fixed over time. So as recently as the early 1970s, abortion was not divided on party lines. And so if you just imagine, if you happen to be born in 1942 and this is 1963, it's very possible that you're a Democrat who has some concerns about abortion, or you're a Republican who believes that abortion is okay. Now, think about that and write about that. Imagine you were raised in different circumstances. How might your views be different? We asked people to do that for just a couple minutes and then engage with somebody from the opposite side. And their approach is radically different. They go from complaining about baby killers and woman oppressors to saying, I don't agree with your stance on the policy, but I respect the fact that you have a worthy principle behind it, which is either, freedom or dignity of life. And they were even more willing to date someone from the other side when they imagined growing up in their circumstances. And I think that this idea of counterfactual thinking, imagine that I was born in a different world or to a different family or in a different time. What it forces you to do is realize that my beliefs are not set in stone, that it's possible I could have a different stance on this issue if I had experienced a different set of life events. And guess what? Now I realize it's possible you could have gone through that too. And that makes me more open to rethinking my views and also maybe puts you in a position where you're more open to rethinking yours.
This program, Firing Line, is a revival of the original Firing Line, which was hosted for 33 years by William F. Buckley Jr. One of the hallmarks of his program, which we have taken inspiration from in this iteration, is that Buckley welcomed all points of view from across the political spectrum and engaged with friends from the opposite perspective. One of those friends was Al Lowenstein, who was a Democrat who was admired by both liberals and conservatives and was a guest of Buckley's on this program many times. I want you to listen to this excerpt from that program in 1971.
Now, first I'll answer what I was trying to answer before you try to get me to answer something I'm not trying to answer. Then I'll answer
what you want not to answer.
Well, I'll answer both in due course. What my feelings are, and I think you would agree with this, is that people, regardless of party labels, ought to work together on issues they agree about. Mm-hmm. We happen to agree about the war. We disagree about the draft, in which I work with you. We agree about the draft. Mm-hmm. I don't think that my agreeing with you about the draft means that I'm committed necessarily to supporting you if you run for president. If so, it would be an awful decision for me to make, because I'd like to work with you. I would like to continue working with you against the draft without feeling that obliged me to support your ambition.
You're being very sly, Al. You're being very sly.
Because I can't keep up with you in the department of being sly.
Two men, opposing political views, able to engage with each other respectfully, humorously, with goodwill, and with a presumption of goodwill. How do we get back to that?
Time machine? We need a DeLorean or a Tesseract right now. I would love to return to that era. What do we do? So I've been thinking a lot about a congressional committee that I had a chance to testify for, where one of the ideas we talked about was actually doing civility scores of politicians. That you would get respected people from both parties to come together and, let's say, just score the tweets. Not on the content, but on whether the tone was respectful. And if you had a low civility score, you would be stripped of committee assignments. You would lose power in the Senate or the House. And there was actually a lot of bipartisan enthusiasm for this, because right now, the 10% on both extremes are basically feeding each other's flames. And over time, what that means is they're probably getting reinforced by bots and by the small minority of people who think that this is tribal warfare and I want to decimate the other side, as opposed to saying, actually, the majority of America is exhausted. They actually believe in compromise. They want to see people solve hard problems together. So I would love to see this experiment run and see if we can move the needle with it. I think the thing that I find myself saying to politicians a lot in terms of individual behavior, and this applies to all of us, even when you're, you know, when you're arguing with your crazy uncle over Thanksgiving dinner, is it's worth remembering, people often say great minds think alike. Great minds don't think alike. They challenge each other to think again. A lot of people think that harmony is about always being on the same page. But if you actually think about what musical harmony is, it's the pleasing arrangement of different tones. And what that means is when somebody disagrees with you, if you object to what they think, you have a lot to learn from how they think. Now, of course, we would all rather be surrounded by people with similar values, but similarity of values is not beneficial unless you also have disparity of views. You know, I think consensus makes us comfortable. It's actually dissent that makes us smarter. And so when you encounter somebody who doesn't share your politics, instead of immediately retreating into your echo chamber or your filter bubble, you could say, wow, I actually learn more from ideas that make me think hard than opinions that make me feel good. I want to surround myself with people who challenge my thought process, not the ones that agree with my conclusions. And I've actually started doing this on social media. I realized most of the people I followed were people I liked. I basically was following people because I liked the answers they gave. And instead, I said, what if I pay attention to people because I admire the intellectual integrity they bring to the questions they ask? In other words, who are the people I would listen to regardless of what conclusion they reached? Because I respect the discipline and rigor of their thought process. And paying attention to those people, seeking those people out for podcast conversations, reading their articles, has taught me so much more than paying attention to the people who hold the same views that I do. And I think what that requires is to recognize that when people challenge your core beliefs, that is not a threat to your ego. It's an opportunity to grow.
The kind of person who is willing to pick up your book and read it, to engage with you in your thinking, as someone who almost definitionally is willing to think again.
Really? You think that? I'm not so sure.
Enough to pick up the book.
I've gotten a lot of angry responses from people who are definitely not willing to rethink things that I'm not convinced.
What about the people who are disinclined to pick up the book? Aren't they the ones who need it the most?
Not necessarily, because I think that a lot of the readers I've heard from are people who are trying to get others to think again and doing a terrible job opening their minds. People who are locked into preacher, prosecutor, or politician mode. And a lot of them, one of my favorite notes of feedback that I've heard a lot is from people who have said, you know, I realized that I needed to be more in scientist mode. And I'm thinking, like, how do you approach a debate or a disagreement like a scientist? It means that you treat the person who disagrees with you like somebody. It's almost like, well, let me give you an example. I think it's unconscionable that we allow mass shootings to happen in this country. And I think there are all kinds of regulations as well as effective experiments that have good data behind them around community policing, for example, that can protect our Second Amendment rights and also prevent mass shootings. And so I believe that it's possible to pursue both at the same time. And I met someone who did it and was just completely opposed to any kind of regulation around firearms. And my first instinct was to go into prosecutor mode and just decimate their views and talk about all the countries in the world where people can get guns, but there aren't mass shootings. Talk about all of the evidence that speaks to some effective interventions that we have. And then I remembered that that's not what a good scientist would do. A good scientist would come into this conversation and say, what a fascinating specimen. Like, how interesting. This is the closest I'll come to meeting an actual alien this year.
Is that a little dehumanizing though?
Not if you do it right. I don't mean to actually treat the person as a specimen. What I mean is, wow, this person has a completely different mental model than I do for how the world should work. And what that immediately does is make me humble and curious, right? It forces me to say, I have no idea how this person thinks. And I would love to understand what makes them tick better. And guess what? If I can ask them thoughtful questions, I'm going to learn more. And then if I do try to persuade, I can persuade on their terms as opposed to mine. But also maybe I'll come to appreciate where they're coming from a little bit more. And I can have a more nuanced conversation with them and the other people I meet who might think like them. So no, I don't want to turn you into a lab rat, right? What I want to do is say, as a social scientist, I've now encountered somebody who can teach me something about a worldview I do not understand.
What you're saying is we're missing humility.
Yeah. And we love to call out a lack of humility in other people, right? When I see somebody who lacks humility, I pounce and I think, you know, okay, let's talk about narcissism and the problems with arrogance and let's try to show them what they don't know. And then what I realize is, but my instinct to do that lacks humility because I've already concluded that I've discovered the truth and my job is to introduce them to the truth as opposed to ask, wait a minute, am I somebody who's committed to being a lifelong learner? If you are committed to being a lifelong learner, guess what? You can learn something from every single person you meet. Everyone you interact with has knowledge and experience that you don't. And if I close my mind to that, then I am limiting my own learning. So I can think I'm right about a particular point, but there is no way that I am right on every single thing I could talk about with every single person. And so I want to come into this conversation realizing there are probably questions that will come up. There are maybe even issues that will be raised where I don't have all the answers. And if I remember that, I'm going to learn more. And that's going to set the tone for the other person to be more open to learning too. Margaret, maybe you'll find this amusing, but I have started coming into arguments when I feel that frustration or righteous indignation bubbling up. I've actually tried to preface this by saying, I have a bad habit of going into prosecutor mode. I've even been called a logic bully, which I didn't realize at first was not a compliment. I'm trying not to be that person anymore. And if you see me doing that, can you please let me know? And two things tend to happen when I do that. One is the other person will call me out and help me catch myself and say, hey, seems like you're trying to win your case here. I didn't think that's what we were trying to accomplish. Can we go back to arguing to learn instead of arguing to win? The other thing that happens though is when I say, hey, terrible logic bully, the other person will often make a confession and say, you know what? I have a bad habit of being the most stubborn person in my zip code. And I'm really trying to be less that way. And so could you help me with that? And guess what? We are now committed to being open-minded and holding each other accountable for that. And that's good for the process of disagreement, regardless of the outcome that it leads us to.
Final question. I'm sure you've seen NASA's James Webb telescope images that have been beamed back down to Earth, this mind-blowing images of deep space. And you've written about the effect that astronauts who, when they first orbit the Earth, have by having the perspective of how small humankind is as they are orbiting the Earth. That reaction, known as the overview effect, you say makes astronauts realize, quote, a common identity within all humankind. Do you think these new glimpses of the unknown in deep space might have a similar effect for all of us?
It's fascinating. We have a remarkable natural experiment. What I'd love to do actually is take people who haven't seen the web images yet and randomly assign them to see them, or maybe the Hubble images or a control group where they don't get either, and then bring them somebody who disagrees with them politically or who might be an adversary in some way and see if they approach them differently. That's a great experiment waiting to be done.
You heard it here first on Firing.
Well, here's my hesitation though, before we get too excited about it. First of all, a good scientist is committed to believing whatever the results show. If you think the methods are sound, right, it doesn't matter what the answer is. And in fact, this is one of my favorite ways to have a good debate with people is to say, if we can agree on what a rigorous study will be, then let's either do that experiment or let's find that study. And we're going to be on the same page because we've already aligned on how to find the truth. But I think that this is part of thinking like a scientist and not letting your ideas become part of your identity. Is you say, whatever these results show, I am going to learn from them and incorporate them into my beliefs. And in this one of my fears is, it's really different to see a screenshot of deep space through the Webb telescope than it is to leave the Earth, right? And see what an astronaut, Jeff Ashby, called the thin blue arc. He said, when I was looking at Earth, I didn't see borders. All I saw was the tiny layer, the ozone layer that protects all life as we know it. And leaving that behind, right, and potentially never coming back to it, that alters you fundamentally. The studies on astronauts that have captured this have shown that they consistently come back with more universalist values. In other words, valuing all humans or even all life and the planet that protects human life in a way that they didn't before. I don't know that just looking at a telescope image can accomplish the same thing. And so I think what we should do is we should take everybody who holds hateful views, we should slingshot them out to space. This is the best empirical argument for space tourism that I've ever seen, and see if that is a lasting shift in their worldview. And I know some people probably will just say, do they have to come back? Like, can we just leave them in space? But I want to bring them back and find out if they become a little bit more concerned with their common humanity.
Adam Grant, thank you for your work, for your research, for your contribution, and for joining me here on Firing Line.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here.